We'll see the Heart Sutra in the shorter version. A praise to the perfection of wisdom, the mother of all the Buddhas. Ineffable, inconceivable, unborn. The longer version also, the Heart Sutra. Nyambar Shoswa Yaan Te Tse Chanchu Sambha Sambha Chambha Chanre Samvan Chushin Parada Chambha Samen Cheva. Just complete the Heart Sutra where I left off. Therefore, Shariputra, the sins Bodhisattvas have no attainment. They rely on the perfection, on this perfection of wisdom and abide in it, having no obscuration in their minds. They have no fear, and by going utterly beyond error, they will reach the end of Nirvana. All the Buddhas will to abide in the three times attain the full awakening of unexalted perfect enlightenment by relying on this profound perfection of wisdom. Therefore, one should know that the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unexalted mantra, the mantra equal to the unequal, the mantra that quells all suffering, is true because it is not deceptive. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is broken of death, agadagada, paragada, paranda, parasangada, bodhi, swaha, shariputra. The Bodhisattva, the great beings, should train in the perfection of wisdom in this way. And thereupon, the blessed ones arose from that meditative absorption and commended the holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, saying, "This is excellent, 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 noble chant. Oh, noble chant. It is just so. It should be just so. One must practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have revealed, for then even the Tathagatas will rejoice." As the blessed one uttered these words, the Venerable Shariputra, the holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, along with the entire assembly, including the worlds of gods, humans, asuras, and gandharvas, all rejoiced and hailed what the Blessed One had said. This is a praise to the mother of all the Buddhas. Verse of salutation from Maitreya's Abhisamaya Alamkara. The verses of salutation from Mula Madhyamaka Karika by Master Nagarjuna, which praises Buddha for teaching dependent origination free from the eight extremes. So today, from many different countries, people have gathered here. People who are followers of the Buddha. So you have come with great enthusiasm. I would like to welcome you all, first of all. Usually we have teachings for the Koreans. First we have, of course, this teachings for the Southeast Asians. And then the Vietnamese and Korean teaching separately. But this time, instead of giving each of these groups, three groups, 2 or 3 days each, we thought that if it's convenient for all the three groups, we would have the teaching together. So as I asked if it's possible. You also agreed, and you have come here together for this teaching. So without having to come separately, you have agreed with what I suggested, and therefore I would like to thank you for this. With regard to the Buddha himself, he also, he lived for about plus 80, and I too am over 80 now and an old monk now. So I need some rest, because if I have a hectic schedule, then I also may face problems. And so you have come all, all of you have come together for this teaching. And each day I'll give teaching in the morning from 8 till around 11:30 for about 3.5 hours. So I'll give my explanation. So in the afternoon, you could have a review session. Of course, if there are people who are in who don't have any spare time for that, that's a different matter. But those of you who wish to have this review and have time for that, we have reviews, geishas and teachers who have been assigned to lead the review sessions. Perhaps you could also have some kind of a discussion with the teacher, the geishe. Not so much as to repeat what I have taught in the morning. You could ask for clarifications and ask questions. And if you have doubts, also you can ask for clarification. So for the next 4 days, you would actually learn Buddhism. Buddhism is about actually learning, gaining knowledge, not so much about gaining some blessing from outside. Of course, we can talk about getting blessings from within ourselves, but in order for the blessings from the outside, the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, we need to actually develop our minds further, to make some transformation through training the mind, and thereby subduing our mind, which is unruly, and also to increase our intelligence and wisdom, and also to develop the together with it, to develop compassion and a good heart. And so through in this way, you could actually gradually have overcome the afflictive emotions and all these negative factors that are in our mind, and make transformation within ourselves. And so in order to do practice of the Dharma, you need to know what to practice. And in order for that, you need to hear the teaching. And therefore, the purpose of our gathering here is you should actually regard it as some kind of a doing some study of Buddhism, not just not so much for receiving blessings from me. So think that you are here for a class on Buddha Dharma. So in the afternoon, we'll have a review session. We'll have review session at 1 o'clock in this main hall for the English-speaking people and Chinese-speaking people. We'll have the review session in the Kalachakra Hall. And so so if we have some time here, we could also I could also take some questions. So usually when there's a Korean teaching, I would speak in Tibetan, and then the Korean or the Vietnamese, whoever is here for that particular teaching, would translate into their own respective languages. So alternate translation would be there. But this time, since we have not, in order to save time, we are not doing alternate translation, but simultaneous interpretation. Did you get tea? So this is how we would go about. So for the teaching, the texts that we are going to go through are of the six collections of reasoning, treatises on reasoning by Master Nagarjuna, we are doing the Ratnavali, or precious garlands, which also, of course, teaches emptiness. So we'll go through the first chapter, not the whole text as such. So the significance is of this is that it shows the methods of attaining higher status or higher rebirth and also definite goodness, which is enlightenment, nirvana. And so we'll go through this text. And then we'll also go through Master Kamalashila's Kamalashila, who was a disciple of Chandrakshita, who wrote a text, this text in Tibet itself, because there was some debate. And so, after the debate between Kamalashila and the Chinese master, the Tibetan emperor himself, King Tisong, the Emperor Tisong Dezen himself requested Kamalashila, Master Kamalashila, to actually write a text. And so he was, of course, a great scholar himself. He has written the Madhyamaka Aloka, the lamp of Madhyamaka, and also Tatusamgraha Panjika, which is the commentary on difficult points of Tatusamgraha by his master Chandrakshita. And so he has written book 1, 2, 3 the middle stages, and this particular text, the middle stages of the meditation, is quite a comprehensive text. So it shows how to actually tame our unruly mind, and then developing our mind further and further, reaching higher experiences, and also how to go tread along the five-tiered path. And just as it is referred by this mantra of Heart Sutra, referring to the parts of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and then part of normal learning, the Buddhahood. And so how to actually, right from the beginning, right at this stage, how the mind that we have is full of negativities, unruly, undisciplined. And so how to discipline this undisciplined mind and then make progress along the path and experiences. And therefore, in order to do that, we need to know the reality as it is on the basis level. And so, having understood the basis level of truth, then, of course, we all do not want suffering, but want happiness. And then we also have a sense of I, and also a feeling, an experience of pain and pleasure. And therefore, we don't want suffering, we want happiness. And so this is something which is natural to us. And so we need to know what causes suffering and what causes happiness. And so by knowing the reality at the ground level, how to use the knowledge to transform our mind. And by transforming our mind, what kind of fruit we actually would reap. And so it covers the basis level briefly and then also goes through the path stages and how to and how one gains those and attains those paths and finally reaches the goal of enlightenment. And so the text, the title of the text itself is Stages of the Meditation. And so it goes through the meditations on shamatha, the single-pointed meditation, calm abiding, as well as vipassana, the insight meditation. And so, therefore, it is a quite a comprehensive text, and teach it quite often. And then, after Master Dipankara Shijana came to Tibet, he taught his lamp for the path to enlightenment, which became the source of all the different Tibetan Buddhist traditions, Sajjan Nyingma Gurdju and Geluk, which going through the common general path. So, and then in the 13th century, perhaps, this master, the author of the other text, which I'm going to go through, Gyatso Thokme Sangpo, who was a contemporary of Budun Thamje, Budun, the omniscient master. So he, Gyatso Thongpa Sangpo was actually known at that time as being a bodhisattva. So in order to reach Buddhahood, one needs to tread the path, the bodhisattva path. And therefore, here the 37 practices of the bodhisattvas is one of the texts which we are going to go through. And then, at the end, we'll conclude this teaching with the dedication chapter of Bodhisattva Charya Avatara by Master Shantideva. So I'm wondering how I should actually begin. Whether I should cover each text separately or begin with, of course I'll begin with the first chapter of the Precious Garland. And then bring in the relevant parts from the other texts as I go through the stages of meditation from the other two texts. So first of all, let's take the tea and bread. Who would say the grace? Koreans? So please say the grace, blessing, for the tea and bread. Prayer. Do you have something, some prayer for tea and bread? Vietnamese. A short prayer for blessing, the tea and bread.
Tất cả công đạo. Vô thượng đạo sư Phật bảo, vô thượng cứu hộ pháp bảo. Vô thượng dẫn đạo tăng bảo, con dân cúng dường tam bảo nơi quy y.
So that was blessing. Do you have a blessing for the bread? That was maybe for tea. Okay. Someone is joking. Where's your tea?
No, I don't want.
You don't?
No.
His Honor is asking how many Chinese people are here for the teaching. So they are scattered. Lugarel. Tishtele. Kasan. Kasan. An old-time friend of His Holiness is asking how's the business in Nepal. So I'll begin the teaching, and you may take time drinking the tea and taking the bread. So as I have already said, we all have a sense of I. As long as that is there, of course we would have the sense of not wanting. I mean, the wish. We would have the wish not to have suffering, but happiness. So, all sentient beings want happiness and do not want suffering. Are the same in that sense, but to actually have happiness and overcome suffering.
Old friend, many years. Now everybody now getting older and older, and get some problem here.
Somebody So the Buddha Shakyamuni, when he taught about the suffering of suffering, he talked about suffering in terms of birth, aging, sickness, and death. So old people, old men and women, do not need to be introduced to suffering through some text, but suffering is actually experienced by us. So, sentient beings, different species of living beings, tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of them are here on this world itself. So all do not want suffering but want happiness. But the other sentient beings do not have the same kind of brain and intelligence like us human beings. And they could avoid some degree of suffering and pain, and then they could live in peacefully when everything is all right around them. But we human beings have this special brain with which we could actually have all kinds of thought processes, and we could know what causes us suffering and what causes us happiness. And therefore, faith traditions, or whether we call it faith traditions or dharma, spiritual traditions, have evolved in human society and not in other animal communities as such. So we could think about how suffering and happiness are caused, what kind of causes and conditions bring them about. And also we know how to overcome the suffering, and we can think about them, the methods to overcome them. And therefore, when human beings encountered challenges and problems and difficulties, they thought about taking refuge in some kind of a higher power. So in the beginning, they were thinking of actually avoiding harms, threats from animals, wild animals, when they were endangered. They took refuge in the forests or caves. And then, during the daytime, as there is sunlight, they could see these animals. They felt really slightly relaxed. And they, in the night, when they couldn't see these wild animals who attacked them, when they were full of fears. And also, they were suffering cold. And then they thought the heat is a refuge. And therefore, the people began also to take refuge in the sun, thinking that the sun has its god and so forth. So even in even today in eastern India, there are people who worship sun and moon and do prayers, and there may be this may be there in other parts of the world as well. And then when people actually found were able to make fire, they found that fire gives heat, and then they also refuge in the fire, and then they also began to see that fire could actually burn things, and therefore they started cooking the animals that they had hunted in fire. And so there are these kind of customs of taking refuge in temporary refuges as well. And then gradually language also evolved, and also letters, scripts, and people's intelligence also increased and became more intensely stronger or more powerful. And therefore, when people actually lost, faced lots of problems, huge challenges, then almost to the point of losing hope, then they actually found some source in which they could actually keep hope, which they called God or the higher powers. And so for the last 3-4 thousand years, people have started taking refuge or seeking refuge in God. And then that God to whom people kept their faith, to back it up, people found some philosophical ideas as well. And so in India, one of the earliest philosophical schools was Sankhya school. So the Sankhya may have developed around 3-4 thousand years, and then in the Arab regions, in the Middle East, Zoroastrianism also developed around 3,000 years ago. So I do not know the details, but then and then also in the Egyptian civilization, they have also the practice of faith, worshipping. And in Chinese civilization also, they also may have developed this kind of faith tradition. And so in the world, there had been the development of this faith in God, considering the God as somebody sacred and he being almighty and all-knowing and all-compassionate. And so such a being was said to have created the world or the universe. And so in Pramanavartika by Master Dharmakirti, such a god, a creator, is termed as Dakparang Chungkikebo, which means a self-evolved, permanent being. So, which means that self-evolved means it's not dependent on any other causes and conditions. And then because he or she is the creator of everything, is called the great Rangchung Kebu. And then in India, also within the Sankhya school of thought, there were two sub schools, one which is theistic and the other non-theistic. And so, according to these Indian schools, that either Ishvara or whatever term name they give to the god, it's said to be the creator of everything. And similarly, in the case of Christianity and Judaism, and also Islam, all of them believe in theistic creator god. But it helps, of course, the followers when they say that everything is created by that God. God is seen as having the ultimate, the absolute power, the supreme power. And then the nature of that, if you ask the nature of that God, they don't say the nature of God is anger or hatred, but all of them say the nature of that God is love. And therefore, when they believe in such a love, the God full of love, then when you keep your faith in such a God, and it will never, they would always feel safe that they will never be harmed by such a God. So since we are created according to them by such God, therefore they also would inspire them to practice love and compassion as well. The main message of God is love and compassion. Not only the Creator God, but all religious traditions, not only theistic religions, but non-theistic religions as well. All the essence of all these teachings, religious teachings, is love and compassion. Therefore, if you have love, however small a sentient being may be, even an insect, down to a small insect, if you have love, then that could actually create relaxation in others. If we show love to a small insect, it would feel relaxed and unharmed, and no fear. And so similarly, birds, wild animals, dogs and cats, if we take care of them with kindness, they would have a different look at us. So of course they cannot laugh at us, but according to our own affectionate care, they would react to us affectionately. And then the cats would come to us and sit in our lap and purr. So when I was little, we had in Novolinka Palace, the summer palace, a parrot in a cage. So one of the Tibetan government officials used to teach me writing, Tibetan hand writing. And so when he came to teach me, he would always offer some nuts to this parrot. So this person became the Jichab Kenpo later. And then as soon as he entered the Novolinka gate, the parrot actually could recognize the footsteps of that person. And because he could hear the footsteps of that person, the parrot also becomes quite excited when my teacher entered the Novolinka gate. And so when he gave the nuts, the parrot would eat it. And then he would actually, my teacher would actually insert his finger through the cage and pat on the parrot's head, and the parrot would like it very much. And so as I was little at that time, I felt jealous of my teacher. So I wished the parrot would do the same to me, react. So I fed him with nuts, and he would take the nuts and then have no other reaction. And so, because he was not showing me any love or appreciation, I lost my temper, and after some days, I actually hit him with a stick. So I could never become friends with this parrot, that parrot. So if we actually take care of the animals with kindness and love, they would really appreciate it. So it is same with any sentient being. So right, even before our birth from the womb of the mother, if the mother has a very relaxed mind state, then it is said that the child also benefits. If the mother is fully disturbed in her mind, then the child, the embryo, also is disturbed. That is what the medical doctors say. So even before our birth, it shows that love and compassion has some impact on the unborn child. And therefore, and then after birth, of course, the mother's care and affection is crucial to the child are bringing. So right after birth, the medical scientists say that if the mother actually kept the child close to her body in her embrace, then it actually helps the child's enlargement of the child's brain. So for the first few weeks, if the mother could do that, it really helps. It really helps the child's development of the brain fully. If the mother neglects the child, then it would hamper the development of the child's brain. And then, of course, we mothers feed, breastfeed their child. So sometimes people take cow milk or something. And so breastfeeding a child is much beneficial because it is said that it has some kind of a special substance. The mother's milk itself has some special substance which actually helps the child's development as well. And this is not the same when a human child is fed with cow milk. And so it could be that we could either call it nature or a karma. So long as a sentient being is actually brought up under the care and affection of her mother, that child also would have the potential to show love and compassion to others as well, affection to others. And then there are the animals such as birds, which give lay eggs, and then the eggs hatch, and baby birds come out. And so the mother birds actually are the ones who take care of the baby birds, feeding them until the baby bird is able to actually survive on its own, feed themselves. So since we have grown up under the affection and care of our mother, we also have that potential. Biologically, we also are equipped with that the affection. And so we actually appreciate love and compassion, which gives happiness to us as well. Since we appreciate love and compassion, and therefore the theistic religions also say that the God Creator has the ultimate love. And so there are, I have many friends, there are very good practitioners of the different religious traditions. If they really sincerely practice their own religion. So I have many friends. So if they really are be practical about their own religion, we could have very good people from these different religious traditions. And so within the non-theistic religions, we have non-theistic Sankhya school, and then also the Jainism, Mahavira, started from Mahavira, and then Buddha Shakyamuni, the teaching of the Buddha, also doesn't assert creator God. And so these three schools, the Sankhya, non-theistic Sankhya, Jainism and Buddhism, these three spiritual traditions are non-theistic. So of course, there are philosophical differences between these three and the other theistic religious traditions. Although philosophically different, they have the same message of love and compassion. So on this earth, there may be 15 or 10 major religious traditions which have some philosophical thesis. So all these three religions have three aspects. One is the religious aspect, or the spiritual or faith aspect. So all the religious traditions talk about love in that sense. So all are same, despite their philosophical differences. So the practice, main practice is love. And then there's a philosophical aspect, so which is within which there are great big differences. But first of all, we have difference between theistic and non-theistic religions. So from the point of view of the theistic religious traditions, the non-theistic religious may be considered nihilists or sinners and so forth. But from the point of view of non-theistic religious traditions, and they would see that theistic religious traditions have some kind of misconception about reality. So philosophically different, but we have to know the purpose of these different philosophies. So whether it's theistic or non-theistic religion, both teach the practice of love. So in order to promote this very message, then we have the theistic and non-theistic religious traditions, which have also evolved according to some the circumstances, geographical and time and so forth. And so what this shows is that the suitability of these philosophical ideas. So even the Buddha himself, seeing the different mental dispositions amongst his own disciples, he taught different philosophical ideas. And so we have four major tenet systems or philosophical schools within Buddhism. And within each of them, there are subdivisions or schools. So all these, all of them are follower of the same teacher, but because they have different mental dispositions, the Buddha himself also acknowledged that and accordingly gave these different teachings of philosophy, the various philosophical teachings. And therefore, we should also use the same logic that because of different mental dispositions amongst different people in different places and different times, and therefore there are these different religious traditions which are suitable to their followers, respective followers, and because they are beneficial to them as well. So as a Buddhist, I have thought about these different philosophical ideas. So we could see in our text that those philosophical schools or religious traditions which have some misunderstanding from the point of view of the Buddhism, and there are different arguments against them.
If you accept, for example, if you accept a permanent, self-evolved, independent being, then what kind of logical fallacies would fall on you or them? So, although there are these different philosophies according to the different religious traditions, what we have to see is how they benefit the followers. And therefore, we need to respect the other religious traditions as well. We cannot cannot regard them as someone that we should actually banish from this place or that place. So even within, I mean, even within Buddhism, if we have to actually argue against each of these philosophical schools, for example, the Vaibhashikas would be banished by the Sutantikas, would have to be banished by Sutantikas, and they would have to be banished by Chittamatras, and then these Chittamatras would have to be banished by the Madhyamakas. That's not... And then within the Madhyamaka system, there are different sub-schools. And so we would have to be endlessly engaging in this kind of a challenge or a problem, a difficulty. And so that's not what we should do. We cannot think of actually... doing that. But we should think that although the other religious traditions are different from ours in terms of philosophy and so forth, but they also are beneficial to their own followers, and therefore we should have respect. And therefore it is very important for us to have harmony amongst all religions. Especially today, in the name of different religions or different denominations within one religion and so forth, people actually kill one another. So it's mainly not because of the religion as such, but because of power and money. So by accepting that the varieties of mental dispositions amongst sentient beings, we need to accept all religions as being beneficial to their followers. Do you agree with me or not? Just because we there are different religions, we cannot think of actually getting rid of the other religious traditions. Even though the Buddha himself came into this world, he was not able to turn the whole of India into Buddhism. And similarly, it is the case with other religions like Christianity and Muslim. I mean, they cannot force people, everyone on this earth, to become Muslims or Christianity. And nor the Buddhists can do that with the other people. And so religious belief has to do with one's own individual choice. And then there is another matter or issue. Today there are 7 billion people on this earth, and over 1 billion are non-believers. And there amongst the non-believers there are people who actually are atheists as well, who oppose religion. But nonetheless, they don't want suffering, they want happiness. And therefore, what we have to recognize Dharma is love. Because Dharma means holding you from suffering or fear. So anger gives us fear, they call it disturbed state of mind, whereas love actually doesn't disturb our mind. And therefore, the main meaning of Dharma or spirituality is love. Even animals appreciate love. No one opposes it. So without really knowing this principle message of Dharma, people sometimes consider building stupas or building temples and statues and so forth. That's more important, the external activities. Of course, this may have evolved because of so most of these religious traditions evolved within some social setup of feudalism. And especially in Tibet, the lamas and leaders are seen as people who actually rule their subjects. And then the economy of the land and political matters also are in their hands. So love and compassion is not something which even the atheists would oppose. So since we have over 1 billion people who are non-believers on this earth, so which is quite a big portion of humanity. So they also don't want suffering but want happiness, and we have to live together with them. And therefore, we need to see how we can, we need to actually engage in spreading love amongst them as well. So, since the Buddha had given his teaching according to the dispositions of different disciples, accordingly, today we need a secular ethics for the practice of morality, for particularly keeping in mind the seven, non-believers. We should not neglect them or but we need to actually embrace them by saying that we, as human beings, we need love and compassion, which is good for our health and also for our peace of mind and also our society, the human community. All the problems arise from our anger, hatred, and these are in turn are rooted in our clinging and attachment as well. And therefore, we need to promote the teaching of love to all human beings. If we could do that, it's very important if we, to do that. And therefore, I usually talk about secular ethics. And secular, the term secular here, I take the meaning according to the Indian understanding of the term, which has the connotation of respecting all religions. We need to, of course, make a difference between faith and respect. Of course, faith is something which is reserved to religions, traditions, and whereas respect, we can have it to all religions. whereas faith can be, we can have faith in our own religion. So today, India is a country which actually has all the major world religions in one country together. And then another meaning of secular, the term secular in India is that to respect even the non-believers. And this is quite significant. It's not distancing ourselves from people who are non-believers as such, but actually respecting. So in India, there was this religious, there was a system of thought called Charvakas, who didn't believe in any spirituality. Or so all of us need love, and if we have love, then we'll be able to overcome our problems. If we have love, of course, then we also have the sense of oneness of human beings. So we all, as human beings, do not want suffering but want happiness. And today, whether it has to do with environment or economy, we are all interdependent. The environment doesn't differentiate between this region or that region. We are all affected equally. And then economically also, each continent cannot remain separately isolated like before. We are all dependent on one another. For example, the economic crisis in China affects other parts of the world. And so, even if you are not affectionate to them, and you could actually take into consideration your own benefit and profit, because your economy, your well-being is also dependent on others. And therefore, think about this. And whether, I mean, in your own country, when you go back, you should also try to promote this, the practice of love and compassion. Whether the people are in your country are believers or non-believers. So this is what I practice, and you should also do the same. So as human beings, we need to actually create a human a community full of love and compassion today. So this is what I actually talk all the time. And then we have many different religious traditions, major religious traditions. So Buddhism is one of the important religions of the world today, although it evolved and started in the East. Many of the Asian countries even today are Buddhist countries, all these countries. Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, China, Korea, Vietnam, Japan, and so forth, Cambodia and so forth. These are all Buddhist countries. So in the past, of course, Buddhism had permeated the whole of India. And then in those days, of course, even the regions like Afghanistan and so forth have become, Buddhism has spread there. So today, the world is very much interconnected in terms of communication, economy, and so forth. Because of this communication exchange amongst people in different parts of the world, although different religions in the past actually started some in some particular region, like Asia or Middle East or in the West, but today these religions have actually spread across the world. So Hinduism also. And then people are also taking interest in yoga. And through the practice of yoga, people also come to take interest in Hinduism as well. In the West, it seems it's spreading. In Australia also. So although in the beginning, of course, after the Britishers went to Australia and the people there followed Christianity in the beginning, but then today it seems Buddhism is spreading there as well, just as it is spreading in Europe and America. So because of our faith in religion, in Buddhism, people began to build temples and monasteries. So we have not taken so much interest in building libraries of Buddhist teachings as such, but temples. So after building a temple, people consider that there must be scriptures in the temple as well. In Tibet, in most of the temples and monasteries and shrines, we have the statue of the Buddha and then the scriptures, the Gangur and Tengur, considering them to be sacred. But these scriptures are considered sacred and holy, people have not taken the time to read them and study them as such. So this is what Tibetans have done, and also similarly in Korea or Vietnam. All of you recite the Heart Sutra, but you do not seem to have in-depth study of the Heart Sutra itself. So some of my Buddhist friends have told me that, of course, we do recite this Heart Sutra, but we don't know the meaning of it. So although we do all these prayers, we are not really paying attention to the meaning and trying to study and learn the meaning of these prayers. Therefore, I've been telling that these scriptures that we have, the Gangur and Tengur, are not just to be put up in the altar, but they need to be used as textbooks. And therefore, I'm telling today, these days, I tell people that as Buddhists, we need to become 21st century Buddhists. What that until the end of the until the 20th century, we have been saying, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But when you are asked, what is the Buddha? And people don't know sometimes. They say, I don't know. So that time is over now. Now we must become 21st century Buddhists to understand what the Buddha means, how someone becomes a Buddha. Someone becomes a Buddha through the Dharma, the principle. And in order to become a Buddha through the Dharma, one first becomes a Sangha on the training level, and then become someone who's gone beyond training. And so in this way, we need to have this aspiration to become a Buddha, and then have this determination to go tread the path and become a Sangha and finally reach Buddhahood. The Buddha himself has said, "O monks and scholars, just as a gold is tested by burning, cutting, and rubbing, likewise you should examine my teaching. Examine my teaching and accept it, not because you have devotion to me." So the Buddha himself says that we should not accept him based on faith alone, but use reasoning. Analyze the teaching, investigate it, and also experiment it. Having done that, then if you find this beneficial to make transformation in your mind, then you should accept my teaching. So this is something quite unique, because most of the other religions the founding teachers have said that the followers should believe them. But the Buddha said, no, do not believe him. We do not need to believe him in right away, but need to check his teaching. For that, we need to have speculative minds. Because if you accept something to be true right from the beginning, then you would not do an investigation. When you speculate, then you will actually investigate and analyze, and then you'll see reason for such and such teaching. When you find the reason for this, then you'll be able to actually gain conviction in it. And when you see that such and such teachings have no reason to support it, good reason to support it, then you should leave it for a while and be neutral to it. Therefore, as Aryadeva says, one needs to be unbiased, intelligent, and someone who aspires to practice. So biased, unbiased here doesn't mean someone without any thoughts. Someone who actually can think through. And in order for that, you need intelligence. So with regard to other subjects like learning grammar or something, we do not need to relate it to wanting happiness, not wanting suffering. But with regard to the Dharma, which is inner science, we need to actually relate it to our mind. And so these three are the qualities or qualifications of a student, the Aryadeva defines. In Tibetan, we have a saying, do not be like a fool who can be led anywhere. But the analogy that is given in the Tibetan proverb is water that is flowing on a floor, and if you have some water on the floor and use your finger to lead it anywhere, it will come there. So one should not be like that. So we should actually check the teachings and finds that if the Buddha, this is what the Buddha said, but if it has to be taken literally, then there are such and such logical fallacies, and it cannot be actually reasoned out. And therefore, we need to have clear intelligence, deep or profound intelligence, and also quick intelligence, and also vast intelligence. Not knowing, not just being able to feel contented by knowing something, but being able to see the thing in a wider from a wider perspective, and have and therefore, in the Indian treatises, we find mention of what are known as the four matters, which is the content of the teachings, and then the temporary purpose, and the ultimate purpose, and then the relationship between these three. And so, by learning the text, we need to see what it actually teaches, and then what is the purpose of this that teaching, and then not just temporary benefit, but what is the actual, the ultimate benefit of the such teaching. And therefore, we would find that, oh, this text has such and such subject matter and such and such temporary purpose and as well as ultimate purpose. And you see the relationship of these three. And through this, then you would actually find an interest in studying the text, and then engage in study as well as reflection and meditation, thereby bringing about experience of the teaching in within yourself. And therefore, you need to be to stay unbiased, impartial, and be able to analyze the teaching. And for that, in India, there have been many epistemology texts on epistemology and logic, even non-Buddhist texts, which teach us reasoning, the procedures of logic. So in Buddhism, we have these texts on logic and epistemology by Dhammakirti, Dignaga, and so forth, which actually bring up or relate the non-Buddhist thesis and the assertions of the non-Buddhist philosophical schools, and also Nyaya school has considered reasoning very important. Although there have been lots of study and philosophical exchanges between the Buddhist and non-Buddhist traditions in India in the past, today mostly the Indian spiritual practitioners are focused on more on rituals and not so much on these kind of philosophical studies. So I have recently met many Indian swamis or religious practitioners, spiritual practitioners, and I've told them that there have been such tradition in the past in India. And so when we study logic, we learn also about what are obvious things that do not need to be reasoned out, and what are the slightly obscured or phenomena which need to be reasoned out and actually inferred through reason. And then, having found the truth through inference, then we would be able to say that use the reasoning called the reasoning to prove the extremely hidden or obscure phenomena. And and then be able to say that, oh, the person who has taught these teachings, which can actually be reasoned out can be taken as reliable. And so Master Nagarjuna and his disciples were really logicians, great logicians. And they actually demonstrated the teaching of emptiness and selflessness through reason. And in Chandrakirti's texts, if you read them, you'll find lots of reasonings used to prove selflessness. And then with regard to the teaching of Madhyamaka, it was brought to Tibet by Master Shandarakshita himself, who was invited by the Tibetan emperor Tisung Detsen in the 8th century. And he was the one responsible for establishing Buddhism, including giving the monastic ordination as well as explanation of the teachings. And Master Padmasambhava was responsible for overcoming the obstacles to the establishment of Buddhism in Tibet and on Tibetan soil. And so Shandarakshita was a top scholar at that time of Nalanda monastic institution, and he was the one, and he was invited by the Indian, the Tibetan emperor. And so, as he was a great logician, and he wrote Tatusamgraha, the compendium of reality. And his master, his disciple Kamalashila, also was invited to Tibet. And he was also, I mean, Kamalashila was also a great logician as well, a Madhyamaka master. And so, in order to do investigation and analysis of the teaching, you need to have the right conditions within yourself. So without which, you cannot do much. So you need to have some knowledge. So it's very important for us to study the Dharma. Therefore, I always emphasize that we need to become 21st century Buddhists. So within the religious traditions, as I said before, we have the theistic religious traditions and non-theistic ones. And within the latter, there are those who assert an independent self or Atman or soul, and the those which, who do not assert such. So the teaching of selflessness, an Atman theory, is taught only by the Buddha. Amongst all the religious founders of different religious traditions, so other religious traditions which assert some soul or Atman theory say that there must be a self or Atman which is different from the mind-body aggregate. And therefore, the Buddha, when he taught the first sermon, gave the first sermon, the Four Noble Teaching on the Four Noble Truths, is what he taught. So this is the big foundation or the framework of the Buddhism. So the Four Noble Truths are the true suffering, true origin, true cessation, and true path. So what the Four Noble Truths actually show us is that suffering comes from its cause. The cessation of suffering also, that state also comes through cause. And therefore, the Four Noble Truths teaching shows the causality. But So the teaching of the Four Noble Truths actually shows the teaching of dependent origination. Pratiti Samutpada means, and therefore it shows that there is no creator God as such. So there are cases where the Buddha remained silent when he was asked whether there is such a creator God or not. So there are what are known as the 14 unresponded And so, through the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha, in actuality, is pointing, indicating that there is no creator God as such. But things come through its causes and the causes and conditions. And then, with regard to the causes and conditions, Master Asanga gives three conditions. One is impermanent condition. This is to counter the non-Buddhist traditions who assert that things come through some unchanging or permanent cause, such as the Vaisheshikas. So, not only that things have causes, but that cause itself is impermanent, because a permanent cause cannot cause something. So it's not enough just to have a cause which is impermanent, but the cause must be compatible with the effect it gives rise to. And then that cause also must have the potential to give rise to the effect it brings about. And therefore, the teaching of the Buddha shows the interdependent nature of things in terms of causality. In Sanskrit, the term for dependent origination is Pratitya Samutpada. Of course, with regard to this very term, dependent origination, there are different interpretations according to the different philosophical traditions within Buddhism. But on the whole, what Buddhism teaches is that there is no independent cause, but things are interdependent. Even scientists today say that. So even scientists are saying that things are very much interdependent, interconnected. Then within the Four Noble Truths, there are the first two pertain to the affliction, the causality of in terms of pertaining to afflictions, and the later two pertain to the causality and pertaining to liberation. And then when we elaborate the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, and the Buddha also taught the 12 links of dependent origination, in which ignorance comes first, ignorance causing karma. And within this 12 links of dependent origination, the Buddha has not made clear who actually goes in this round of birth and death. Because the person is someone who is designated on the basis of the mind-body aggregate, therefore the Buddha did not mention that a self is the one who goes into this round of birth and death as such. And then, with regard to the Four Noble Truths, suffering has its four attributes, which are impermanence, that it's impermanent, that it's in the nature of suffering, and that it's empty and without self. So this impermanence here is not just a gross understanding of impermanence, but it is this temporary, momentary change in things. Where Bhashyakars actually define something impermanent as having these four states of birth, abiding, ceasing, whereas Sotrantikas say that as soon as something comes into being, it also disintegrates. So this sounds quite strange, doesn't it? But this is true. So something comes up that very moment, one moment, and that very moment it disintegrates. And that disintegration is not brought about by some third factor, but the very cause which has brought about, which has brought it about, is the factor that causes its disintegration itself. So since suffering also goes through this transition from one moment to moment, and it is brought about its cause, and that cause is ignorance. So when you put end to that ignorance, then the suffering, when you see, oh, the suffering has come through its causes, which are ignorance, and which are the afflictive emotions and karma, then what you will actually see is that since this psychophysical aggregate, the five aggregates that we have now, which are contaminated, are brought about by our karma and afflictions rooted in ignorance. Therefore, it could be seen as something which is unpleasant. So since it was brought about by its cause, and that cause is our karma and delusions, which are rooted in ignorance, then we need to see that this ignorance and the afflictive emotions and karma must be overcome. So we would have to go to that cause, karma and afflictions, the negative emotions. And since they are rooted in ignorance, we have to know what that ignorance is. And within the ignorance, there is the ignorance of there are two: ignorance of karma, causality, and ignorance about the true the reality of how things are. And then, what is this later type of ignorance? So when you understand this, you find significance in the teaching of the Buddha, saying that all our suffering have come through ignorance. Now, in order to identify this ignorance, we are talking about the distorted kind of ignorance, which is a misconception of the reality. And therefore, we need to see, we need to know the reality. And there are many different interpretations of reality as it is, according to the Vaibhashikas, Sautantikas, and then Chittamatras, and also Madhyamakas. So reality as it is, Tekonanyi in Tibetan, is interpreted differently by these different schools. And so accordingly, we will find that there are different degrees of subtlety in understanding the reality. So of all these different explanations or interpretations of reality as it is, the philosophical view or understanding of Master Nagarjuna is the ultimate one. Even within the teaching of the Buddha, in sutras, for example, the Sandinimocana Sutra, the sutra unraveling the intention or the thought of the Buddha, goes through what are known as the three natures, which actually interprets why the Buddha taught gave the first and second turnings of the wheel of Dharma, and particularly the Panchaparamita Sutras. So according to Sandinimocana Sutra, the Panchaparamita Sutra is an interpretable, considered as interpretable sutra, whereas according to the Nagarjuna's Madhyamaka system, the highest Madhyamaka system, the Panchaparamita Sutras can be taken literally. And we do not need to resort to scriptural quotation as such, but we actually can use reasoning. So Master Nagarjuna, his disciples Aryadeva, and then their followers Buddha Palita, Chandrakirti, and these teachers have written their treatises and explanations of Nagarjuna's and Aryadeva's texts, and therefore we can gain understanding of the reality as it is according to them very precisely. So today, in physics, there is quantum physics. Of course, they do not relate to mind as such, mental states as such, but they look at external things, physical things, and then which can be measured, and then calculations could be done, and so forth. So, in quantum physics, the scientists say that nothing exists objectively, and nothing can be found if you actually look for the thing in them. And so this is similar to what Madhyamaka says, that nothing objectively exists. Niels Bohr. So one of the persons, the pioneers, I think, of quantum physics was Niels Bohr or somebody. He had, having searched for the things, the matter and so forth, I mean, he was said to have actually felt startled by not being able to see anything objectively existing. So the Buddha himself has said that something that has come through conditions do not have any objective independent existence or arisal or birth, because it has come through other conditions. So when it comes to proving why things do not have any objective existence, in Master Nagarjuna's tradition, it is said that because things are dependently originated, and therefore that is the reason to prove that things do not have any objective existence. So Nagarjuna says what is dependently arisen is said to be empty, and that is said itself said to be designated, and therefore it is the middle way. And so since things are empty of any independent existence, how do things exist then? Is by dependence. And therefore, and also we can say that because things are dependent, they do not have any objective existence. Although they do appear to have some objective independent existence, they do not have such a way of existence at all. And therefore, the teaching on selflessness, meaning there's no independent self apart from the body and the mind, or the psychophysical aggregates. Since there's no self or Atman or soul which rules or governs the body and the mind. So Buddhism not only rejects any creator God, it also rejects such an independently existing soul or self, Atman. But for us, it seems as if there is something, as some essence called self. But there is no such self. So we feel that there's something, some kind of self, somebody called self or yourself, as if you can actually point your finger at it. Or we also feel that there is this experiencer and feel that, I mean, there is a self. But if you actually were to assert such an independently existing self, I mean, you will not be able to find it through when you actually go investigate it within yourself. So as long as you are not able to actually come to the point of understanding that there is no, I mean, independently existing self, but that self is merely designated, I mean, there's going to be some degree of assertion that there is a self, some kind of self within. And therefore, the Four Noble Truths becomes the big kind of a framework of within which we could work the teachings of the Buddha. So which shows that things come through only causes and conditions, and there is no external doer. And the experiencer of pain and pleasure, there is no independently existing self apart from a self which is designated. And therefore, Nagarjuna and these Madhyamaka teachers say that the appropriated body and the mind and the appropriate person also, although they are there, they are dependently designated on the basis of the person, the aggregates are designated, said to be his or her aggregates and so forth. And then on the basis of these aggregates, the psychophysical aggregates, the self is designated. So this is to give you a broad overview of the teaching of the Buddha. So in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha has taught that suffering, the four attributes, and then the origin of suffering also has four. Which are cause, source of all, and then condition, and then the intense condition. So what condition refers to is that things do not come about without causes. And so, as I gave you the three conditions given by Asanga, I relate the impermanence, the condition of impermanent condition with the cause, and then the potential condition with the intense condition. And then the other condition of Asanga to the source of all. And then with regard to the condition of this, which is the third attribute of the origin of suffering, the suffering comes through, I relate that to our the craving and grasping. So we have this distorted conception of reality, which is the ignorance, the fundamental ignorance, as I said earlier. And this can be actually eliminated from the mind, because the very nature of the mind itself is luminous. And mind can be trained so that the negative emotions that are in our mind can be overcome through by applying the counter forces or the antidotes. So these negative emotions that are in us, which disturb our peace of mind, have their causes and conditions, but these can be overcome. And when you are able to overcome these causes, then what you reach is peace. And that peace is not just temporary, but it is an eternal or lasting peace. And therefore, it is an excellent experience. And so the overcoming of the delusions also not temporary, but permanent. And therefore, you reach the liberation or cessations. And in order to bring this about, the cessation with all these four attributes within ourselves, we actually develop the path. So the path is that principle that you develop within yourself. And then Rigpa means awareness. Not just called the awareness or understanding gained through listening and reflection, but listening or hearing, but it also has to come through reflection and meditation. And therefore, in order to practice these, in order to actually do our practice of based on the Four Noble Truths, we go through what are known as the 37 factors of enlightenment, or sometimes it's called 37 harmonies of enlightenment. The first four are the four mindfulnesses. The mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feelings or experiences, and mindfulness of mind, and then mindfulness of phenomena, referring to the selflessness or emptiness. So Of course, through the practice of these 37 practices or factors, we may not be able to see change in ourselves on a day-to-day basis. But if you look back after a year, you may find some change. So year by year, you can make transformation. And then the next four factors within the 37 are what are known as the four exertions or four abandonments, which means that you develop those qualities which you have not gained yet and actually promote them when what you have, enhance what you have, and to avoid the negative or to overcome the negative qualities within yourself, and to enhance those you or and to not to, to refrain from the negative developing the negative ones that you do not have. So you need to do meditation, single-pointed concentration, as well as analytical meditation, and combine them. So the stronger your these practices develop within yourself, and the stronger your concentration becomes, you will have a stronger or a more powerful way of analyzing the things, and vice versa. And then this, you will see more transformation within yourself as well. And so through your experience, you'll be able to actually develop conviction and faith in the teachings. And therefore, we have the five faculties and five powers, and then sevenfold path to enlightenment. And then the Nasik. So I had been to Indian Kumbh Mela in the past in Allahabad, and then recently I was in a Kumbh Mela in nearby Nasik. And so I did a fire puja offering. The fire puja they had set up is actually the one which we call a fire puja for increase. So the stick with which I had to actually pour ghee or butter, pure butter, into the fire was actually made of wood. And so if I had to hold this on the fire for too long, it might catch fire. So we Tibetans use metal objects to do that. So, except in our case, we make the offerings called separately, one by one, whereas they have actually mixed all the ingredients together. When they offer the ingredients into the fire, they actually hold the index finger and the thumb together, and then use the three the fingers to throw the ingredients into the fire. So we have the same kind of practice, except for minor differences. So we might say that we as Buddhists, our fire puja offering is much better than the Hindu, havan. But that is what I actually, what came to my mind. So I was told that the disciples of the main Swamiji, and actually who were reciting all these prayers, had memorized those prayers, but they are yet to actually learn the meaning of them. This is also similar to our monks and who, you know, memorize lots of prayers, but need to learn the meaning. So the Buddha gave the teaching of the Four Noble Truths first, and then he actually showed the progression along the path in the perfection of wisdom teachings, where he actually goes through, in which he teaches the five-tiered path. In the Heart Sutra, for example, we find mention of that, the Gati Gati Paragati Parasangati Bodhiswaha. And so we need to understand the Four Noble Truths and then go into the deeper teachings of emptiness. And then through that, we need to also go into the understanding and insight into the nature of mind as well. So the Buddha gave first teaching of the Four Noble Truths, and then the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, he gave, which is also called the teaching of this characteristic less, and so we'll have a break here. If you need to go to the loo, please do so. And then when you get back, we'll have tea for 15 minutes. And just an announcement here, we'll do the review session with the abbot of Namgyal Monastery for the those who need English translation. Please keep this in mind. At 1 o'clock, we'll have the review session at 1 o'clock.
Now, His Holiness, with your previous teaching, you said that actually when we do the meditation...
Yes.
Okay. In our previous lesson, you said something about when we do the emptiness meditation... When we do the emptiness meditation, we do the analytical part as well. And then when it becomes unstable, we actually shift it to the mind stream and meditate on the mind stream. Okay, I repeat. The Holiness teaching last 2 years, he mentioned when we... meditation during the emptiness meditation, and then when it becomes unstable, we actually shift it to the mind stream. We meditate on the mind stream.
That's actually, of course, everything exists. Everything exists, as the quantum physicists say, nothing objectively exists. So now, although every phenomena does not exist by independently, so therefore every phenomena is in the nature of shunyata.
Hello.
However, hello. You see, we, I think here,
excuse me.
We need to explain.
Can you check if you're hearing or not?
Meditate on shunyata of mind.
Hello.
So therefore...
You are listening to the English, right?
So yeah. The concentration...
Hello. Can you hear?
Focusing.
Hello.
Firstly, mind.
Hello,
itself.
Hello. Testing, testing. Testing,
further
testing.
Further investigate.
Testing.
You cannot find the mind.
Testing, mind, testing.
Here testing. Also now.
FM testing, FM testing.
Mind,
here. Okay.
Like every phenomena, past, present, future. Analyze, nothing there. So then, through that way, investigation, you see, you feel, oh, mind, nothing. However, you see, the meaning of nothingness at that moment, that means because mind exists in the dependency, with dependency, not independently. So we try to find out the very nature of mind. The very nature of mind, since it exists, depend on other factor, not by itself. So when we investigate what is the nature of self, then nothingness. Then meditate on it. Feeling. See, something, some kind of nothingness. Then that intensity little reduce. Then again, the think, mind, let the appearance of mind come. Then again, try to investigate. That's the way. So, okay.
Thank you.
Of course, later also is a come.
Thank you.
What did you do? Thank you.
Your Holiness, how do you know that you have achieved true emptiness when you can still feel at most times? So how do you know when you will actually get true emptiness?
So, emptiness does not mean nothingness. I am here. Buddha also there. But if we investigate, we cannot find Buddha. So there is Buddha's emptiness. So the investigation about Shunyata, not Chajanthare. Not object itself. Now object here, I'm here, my body is here. You see, if we deny that, that's foolish. Actually, I self is there. Buddhahood also there. So we're trying to achieve Buddhahood. So that's 100% right. But at the same time, the appearance of Buddha, Buddhahood, the appearance of ourself, appears something independent. When you look at me, they are Dalai Lama. So it will not sort of kasoda appear just Dalai Lama, just mere name. When I look at Thai monk here, you see, it's something independent. True Thai monk there independently exist. That's the illusion. That illusion is true. That's the illusion. If true independent Thai monk there, then this Thai monk's Trinang. Body is Trinang. Monk's Trinang. Body, not the monk. Your mind, that monk's mind, not the monk. Now where is mind? Where is the monk? Beside this body, and beside the Thai language, nyang, 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 beside that, then beside the Thai brain, Thai mind, Thai mind. Where is Thai? Thai monk. Do you find I'm an independent monk? Independent self? No, you can't find. Like quantum physics, You see, investigate. Then they found nothing exists by objectively. So nothing. So the quantum physicists, you see, they utilize the reason just to find out. They can't find. The Madhyamaka philosophy, you see, use the reason. Things exist due to other factor. So then, because it depends on other, not exist by itself. Absence of independent existence. Because it depends on many other factors. Self. Entirely Thai self. Thai monk. Entirely depend Thai body and mind. So the combination of body and mind, just we designated Thai being, Thai person, then Thai monk. So Buddha also like that. Buddha Shakyamuni. If you investigate, where is Buddha? Beside Buddha's body, Buddha's mind, Buddha's speech, you can't find. Yet, Buddha exists. But the existence of Buddha
is
mere designation, not objectively exist. So this understanding, direct antidote of feeling of grasping independent existence. So all destructive emotion, clash, all clashes depend on the feeling of something independently exist as appears. Now that's the basis of all destructive emotion. So you see, the best weapon to kasoda, to combat or against the emotion, the clash, is understanding of shunyata or anatma theory, like that. So it becomes important. The altruism, wonderful, not direct sarva, so the opposite, ka, antidote. So the wisdom side, wisdom, panja, not ubaya. Panja is the weapon. Ubaya is holder of that weapon. Clear?
Tatamelo.
Chatam saru.
Now, okay, I'll start my lecture.
Okay.
Tan the local DD, Pida, Nansu, Motum. That Pelea, Colo, Tambo.
What we heard so far is sort of an introduction to Buddhism and the three wheels of Dharma, which are in the Pali scriptures. So the meaning of the three baskets the Buddha taught out of his own life experience. First he became a monk, meditated and did penance for 6 years, and then attained enlightenment. And finally, it practiced the concentration of Vipassana and Shamatha on selflessness, and then attained liberation. And so his practice subsumes into the three trainings of wisdom, concentration, and ethics. So that's what the Buddha teaches us to follow as he did, practice in the three trainings. And so all those teachings on the subject of discipline and moral ethics falls into the training of ethics, and on wisdom into the vast basket of wisdom, and then those on meditation falls into the basket of concentration. Regarding the first wheel of Dharma, it's a teaching the Buddha taught as a public teaching in front of hundreds of teachings in front of the public. But regarding the second wheel of Dharma, the Prajnaparamita teachings, this group of teachings, the Buddha somehow didn't teach in public. Because as I usually say, in most Prajnaparamita teachings, you can see that the teachings were mainly discussions between Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra, and while the Buddha was meditating, and at the end the Buddha gave his approval to their discussion. So these teachings are more or less like blessed teachings, not directly spoken by the Buddha, but rather approved by the Buddha, this discussion between his two students. So therefore, while Shariputra is a human being, Avalokiteshvara was not a human being. So it is clear that this Prajnaparamita two teachings are not public teaching, because Avalokiteshvara cannot be seen by the ordinary public. So Shariputra would be, to the appearance of the ordinary people, Shariputra would be just, you know, murmuring something by himself. So therefore, the second wheel of teachings, second wheel of Dharma teachings, are not available in the Pali tradition, whereas they were preserved in the Nalanda tradition, in the works of Nalanda masters like Nagarjuna, like that. So the original sutras were there in Sanskrit, and as a result, the treatises composed by the great masters were also in Sanskrit. Also at that time, Nalanda was sort of a learning institution there since long time ago. According to some sayings, it was there even there during the time of the Buddha, and maybe even predate the Buddha. It's sort of a scholar's learning center. So Buddhist scholars went there and studied. So there people study the five major sciences and five minor sciences, like Sanskrit, Buddhist philosophy, medicine, like that. So since Sanskrit was there in the curriculum, so Sanskrit somehow became like the scholarly academics language, because also because the language itself is a very profound language, very sophisticated. So therefore, the scholars used Sanskrit as the medium of their scholarship. and wrote all the treatises in Sanskrit. So, for example, Nagarjuna's works in Sanskrit and also like Dharmakirti's were considered very high Sanskrit. So therefore, the most of the teachings of the second wheel of Dharma are in Sanskrit. So therefore, usually say the Pali tradition, I make this categorization, Pali tradition and Sanskrit tradition. And the Sri Lankan tradition and many of the Thailand like that, they follow the Pali tradition. And now, with regard to the Vinaya, the monastic rules and moral ethics teachings, whether it's the Pali tradition or the Sanskrit, both share the same teachings. So the Sri Lankan tradition is the Theravadan tradition, so is the Thai and Burma, whereas the Tibetan tradition is the Mulsavastava, and so there are four basic traditions, Vinaya traditions. The one in Chinese tradition, Mangul Vedeba. And in the rules for the monks, then many of the rules are same. For example, regarding transgressions in the Sanskrit tradition, there are 112, whereas in the Pali tradition, His Holiness said, I couldn't remember. In the Sanskrit, also regarding how the monks wear their robes, there are seven styles, seven rules for wearing the monk's skirt. In the Pali tradition, there is one rule. So in these smaller minor aspects, there are some differences, but on more like important things like the four basic downfalls, pambashi, like that, both traditions share the same numbers of rules like that. And regarding the wisdom basket of wisdom, there are two. Now, one that focuses primarily on the selflessness of the person, and one that focuses on the selflessness of the phenomena. So in the Prajnaparamita teachings, these teachings focus more on the selflessness of the phenomena, whereas in the Four Noble Truths, there's more focus on the selflessness of the person. Therefore, for example, at the beginning of the Heart Sutra, you see the word the five aggregates should also be seen as empty of inherent nature. So there is an also signifies that in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha said the selfless taught the selflessness of the person, but in the second wheel of Dharma, the five aggregates are also empty of inherent nature. So, but the fact remains that the Pali tradition is the very foundation, the basic of Buddhism. And so it's not all right to make a division between Mahayana. Some people say Mahayana and Hinayana, and Mahayana is superior. That is totally wrong. So, some, for example, we those who claim to be Mahayana, we are not qualified Mahayana. So, because I mean, Mahayana. So, we must understand that the Theravadin tradition, or in other words, the Pali tradition, sort of lays out the foundation of Buddhism. And whereas in the Sanskrit tradition, the fourth truth is further subsumed in sort of into the two truths. And true truths were made the foundation, sort of the beginning point, and then the four noble truths came out of that. So when you say the truth of cause in the four, in the Sanskrit tradition, then it the truth of cause refers to the most subtle ignorance, which is the ignorance of grasping the inherent self. So, it is, we shouldn't, it's sort of a bad tendency to make division between Theravadin tradition and Mahayana tradition. It's that's just total misunderstanding. The Pali tradition, the Theravadin tradition, they preserve the Vinayas so well. The Thai, His Honest, just mimicked the Thai monks' way of saying the praying the sutras. In the world, all the different religious traditions should be harmonious, and especially within Buddhism, the Pali tradition and the Sanskrit tradition should really be like brothers and be harmonious and in good terms, and should have exchanges of knowledge, and should be united and study from learn from each other. In the Varanasi Tibetan Institute of Higher Studies, we have already introduced the study of Pali over there, and we have to improve that, develop that further. So today, for example, usually when I teach, there are always like some people from the Pali tradition attending my teaching. But today, it seems like the maximum number of people have attended. So let's begin from the Ratnavali by. So. 네가 시행자 듣다가 알래. 아. 아.
뭐야? 딸이.
아.
이제 나 엄마 대주 채 개고로 당적으로 무시 당하면서 저들이 그 체류자에 대유 공기 아주 중기 뒤에서 체제.
So this the Ratnavali by Nagarjuna is sort of written as sort of So this text is a text which has teachings for this practices of this life to attain happiness of this life, also for teachings for future life, liberation, and teachings for complete enlightenment. Whereas Madhyamika Moolakarika by Nagarjuna is mainly addresses the topic of emptiness. So therefore, I chose this text for this teaching. So the text starts, "Homage to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, I bow down to the omniscient, freed from all defects, adorned with all good qualities, the sole friend of all beings." At the beginning of all Tibetan translations of Indian treatises, there is what is called a homage, translator's homage. Here, the homage is homage to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So, this translation's homage shows in which of the three baskets the particular work falls into. In the Tibetan tradition, there are about 100 Tripitaka sutras and 202 translations of treatises and commentaries. About 20, I think his holder said that, were translated from Chinese. They were first translated from the Sanskrit into Chinese and then from Chinese to into Tibetan. And the remaining came from direct translation, were translated directly from India. So when this text, which is called Raja Parikatha, Ratnavali, when Tibetan translators translated them, they were not translated by looking at the dictionary for words and then translated word by word, but rather the Tibetan translators were themselves fluent in both Sanskrit and also in the Buddhist philosophy and the content of the work, and then they also collaborated with an Indian scholar and then translated. And also at that time the Tibetan words were in the process of being invented for Buddhist translation. So as translations were being made, new Tibetan words were invented. So therefore, the terms were very, very accurate, because they were invented just for the purpose of the translation, and that helped enrich Tibetan. So these days, Tibetan is perhaps the most accurate translation. Accurate translation of Sanskrit. Sanskrit works, therefore, perhaps Buddhism, Tibetan language, is the best language to explain Buddhist commentaries of Nalanda works. So His Holiness just read the first verse, which is for paying homage to the Buddha. Which says, homage to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, I bow down to the omniscient, freed from all defeats, adorned with good call, all good qualities, the sole friend of beings. The third the sole friend of all beings, His Holiness explains that it's just like the Buddha helps sentient beings out of his great compassion, just like it is said in the Dharmakirti's the first verse of Dharmakirti's second chapter of Brahmanadvartika, in which the verse says that out of compassion the Buddha was born. So through familiarizing and through practicing compassion, omniscience was attained. And so why is the Buddha the sole friend of all beings? Because the cause is the method, compassion, and the wisdom, emptiness. And due to that, the meaning of the line, freed from all defects, this could be actualized. And also the adorned with all good qualities. So the Buddha is freed from all defects, adorned with all good qualities, because of these two primary causes of compassion and wisdom. So So the perfect, so in most of Nagarjuna's works, he pays to the Buddha by praising the Buddha's speech mainly. In most his treatises, it's like that. In Madhyamika Mulakarika also it's like that, and Rigpa Tukchupa and some other text. So, generally, there are different ways of praising the Buddha through his body, physical qualities, through his mental qualities. But in Nagarjuna's works, mostly he pays homage to the Buddha by praising the Buddha's speech. Because when Nagarjuna writes, he mainly the greatest quality of the Buddha is his teaching on the topic of interdependent origination, and so which is a legacy of the Buddha's speech. So the next line, O King, I will explain, practice solely virtues to generate in you the doctrine. For the practice will be established in a vessel of the excellent doctrine. So, you know, when here we have to understand that when in Buddhism it is said that you are not allowed, you are actually not supposed to teach if people don't ask you to teach. You should teach only when people ask you to teach. So here the king asked Nagarjuna to teach, and so for example, it's useless to teach false on non-believers' teachings. They have no interest. So don't. It's better to teach rather science about. When we have love and compassion, then there's happiness. On the other hand, if you stay as a short-tempered person, always in an angry mood, you won't feel happy, and also others won't be able to approach you. And also fear and insecurity. If you have fear and insecurity, then whoever you meet, you may think, oh, this person may harm me, this may, he's lying to me, he's sort of despising me or something like that. On the other hand, if you have love and a positive state of mind, and just be sincere and talk nicely to people, and there's less fear and insecurity. the immediately the mind relaxes. It's, you know, you can't say, tell a person, please, you should believe in life after death. Please do that. It's just totally, it's just stupid to do like that. So you, the point is that teaching should be given to the right vessel, the right person. That's what it says here. For the practice will be established in a vessel of the excellent doctrine. For example, the four noble truths and the four schools of philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, and all those sophisticated and complicated concepts and ideas and divisions. If you try to teach those to somebody not interested, it's just totally it's just useless. It's just extra burden. It's better rather to just not let the person be alone. So therefore, you should teach only to the right vessel, and to the right vessel. What kind of disciple? What should you teach? So that is shown by the third line, third stanza, in one who first practices high sutras status. Definite goodness arises here for having attained highest status. One comes gradually to definite goodness. So first, the teacher should teach on the teaching of attaining higher rebirths, like human and God rebirth. And second, about teaching on attaining liberation. So in the 400 verses, it is said that first teach, eliminate the non-virtuous actions which leads to lower rebirths, and teachings should be given which attains higher rebirths. And then teachings for attaining liberation should be given, like that.
Thank you.
Okay. So,
I think the scarf should wear your own neck as a symbol of blessing. At the consist of
So if you are animal like cat and dogs, like it's really very you are in a state of very miserable state, because you can't do anything. You cannot think intellectually. So there's nothing you can do. You are an object of sympathy and compassion. But if you are a human being, then you have the capacity to think and to understand. And that's when you have to take advantage of this human position, human status. So we have this discriminative power, and then first understand, study Dharma, then contemplate on their meaning, and then finally put into practice. We will now stop here with Ratnavali and we move on to the middling stages of meditation by Kamala Shila. So it's same as before, first the title, then the homage. So His Holiness says he may not read the go through each stage like because that's not very important. This text is composed by Kamala Shila. There's a story that during the time of Shadarakshita, the king Shadarakshita and the Shadarakshita advised the king to build the Samye Monastery, the first monastery of Tibet. And this Samye Monastery was made with several departments, in which in one department stays monks who take monastic vows, and then in another monastery was a translation section where they started translating sutras from India. And then another section in which there was it's called the Department of Unwavering Meditation, Concentration. That means that since the time of Songtsen Gampo, earlier king, when the Chinese princess Wenjin Gongzhu came to Tibet, came together with her a group of Chinese monks and monks meditators. So they were staying. Since then, there's a stream of Chinese meditator teachers staying in Lhasa, and they were put there in that department to do their meditation practices. And then since Guru Rinpoche was a tantric, not a monk, not a celibate monk, and he was wearing a white sort of dress robe. So a fourth department was made in which tantrics wearing white robes were stayed and did their tantric practices. So at that time, Shantarakshita was alive, and there was no problem, no conflict between the four sections. But following the Shantarakshita's demise, subsequently, among those Chinese, those in the Chinese monks who were doing meditation and concentration, rose some kind of a developed view that you just have to do only meditation, no need for study, and also no need to, when in meditation you should think of nothing, just empty, blank, and So the king became a little bit sort of doubtful about that view, because when Shantarakshita was there, Shantarakshita emphasized a lot on study also, and he was a great scholar himself. But then, so he invited Kamalashila, one of Shantarakshita's great disciples in India, Nalanda, to come to Tibet. And so Kamalashila came to Tibet. So according to this story, the king arranged a debate or sort of a dialogue between those Kamalashila and those Chinese Haoxiang, Chinese monks, meditation masters, on this view that just meditation alone is enough, and no need to study. So, following that dialogue and discussion, debate, Kamalashila composed this text saying that just meditation is very important, but meditation alone is not enough. It should be based on thorough study and intellectual understanding, on wisdom especially. So, in other words, wisdom and concentration should be combined, and both are important, and so vipassana and shamatha. So that's the content of this text. And so this text has three stages. The first stage, second middling stage, and the final stage. The middling stage is a sort of in the third stage, there's a lot of sort of, there seems to be some certain amount of debate, refutation, and logical explanation, whereas in the middling stage is sort of more like a comprehensive gist of the entire point of this text. So regarding this transmission of lineage of this teaching, and this came from Kham, and His Holiness received it from Khenpo Sangye Tenzin, who received it from a master from Kham, who has background in Dzogchen tradition. And regarding the Ratnavali teaching, His Holiness received it from Sevon Rinpoche. And Madhyamaka Mulakharika, His Holiness received from Khunlama Tenzin Gyentsen.
다시 보면 봐봐. 500만. 다시 보면 몇 개는 진짜 몇 개는 죽을 뜻이야. 다시는, 다시, 내가 이제 쉬어야 돼. 다시도, 과자마. 아니, 쌍이 죽고 막 토리하지.
So at the beginning, the text shows that the enlightenment is attained through causes and conditions, not out of no cause or no condition. Whatever is momentary and changes arise from cause and condition. So this is called the dependent origination of causality. So, as I said before, there is no static permanent self or no singular self. So this teaching on the interdependent origination of causality shows that such things are not possible, because everything is that is momentary and that is that changes from moment to moment. So the fact that they are momentary infers that they arose from cause and condition. So therefore, since we want happiness and do not want unhappiness, so we have to understand the cause of happiness and develop that and stop the cause of unhappiness. And regarding this cause and condition, it's not enough to just know what is the cause, but the cause, there are many causes and conditions, so the cause and condition should be complete. Just one cause cannot give rise to many results. So many causes, assembly of causes, or in other words, complete causes should be there. And no matter if you depend on a wrong method or wrong cause, no matter how much you strive, it's just pointless. If you want peace, we should employ the right method. Then we will get peace. We want peace and we employ the wrong method, like making more artillery, more weapon, then how will we get peace? So if we want mental peace and we practice Dharma, but the Dharma we practice is like a Dharma which of sort of competition. My religion is better, he's their religion is not good, then there's no point. It's pointless. So real happiness in the mind. Because the word happiness is a feeling, internal feeling. And unhappiness also likewise internal feeling. So it's a mental phenomena. So the happiness we seek is a mental happiness, but we think it comes from money. It's a wrong strategy. So we have to find out how will we get that mental happiness and find the right cause. The modern education is very advanced.
Material value, external value. So that the education
now,
yeah.
time for lunch. See, Thai monk, they are very strict. The lunch must start before 12. So now, very good. Yeah, that is tough.
So, His Holiness stopped here because the Thai monks must have their lunch by exact noon. In the afternoon, Geshe Ma, German Geshe Ma Kesan Wangmu will translate for the review section. Review session with Geshe Sure. Morang Jire. The review session will be led by at the abbot of Namgyel Monastery, and the translation will be served done by Geshe Kesan Wangmu, German.